were brought in their place. Another one of the reasons is because the rulers themselves were morally decadent and corrupt. They had ethical problems. They had a weak understanding of Islam. And if they did have an understanding of Islam, they did not practically implement Islam in their own daily lives, let alone the lives of those around them or government officials. So from the top down, we see that this ethical and moral degradation and decline of the Muslims had been occurring for quite a bit of time now. Historically, even if we look at Yazid, the son of Muawiyah, who was the son of one of the staunchest enemies of Islam by the name of Abu Sufyan, Yazid was openly known to have been a drunkard who drank alcohol, who was a womanizer, who brought dogs and monkeys into the sacred places of Islam. Of course, an individual who killed the grandson of the Messenger of Allah and also fired catapults at the Holy Kaaba, the house of the Almighty Allah, and made a stable for the horses of his army, which was known as Masjidun Nabawi, the Prophet's Masjid. So, of course, with such kind of rulers, it is expected that the Muslim Ummah and the Muslims will face a moral and ethical decline, if not destruction, of this Islamic moral and ethical value system. So in these conversations that Imam al-Jawad had with the people, he spoke to them about these different moral and ethical values, because this is what needed to be revived at that point and time. And so, of course, glory over the years amongst the Muslims, this idea of what glory is became, you know, watered down, it became corrupted. And people thought that glory, again, came about via wealth and property and power, you know, one who killed the most opponents and the one who killed the most of their personal enemies. It was considered to have great glory and grandeur, or one who was very tyrannical or oppressive upon the people was considered to be, you know, glorious and to have glory and to have this kind of grandeur, or one who was very wealthy, or one who, you know, didn't care about the poor or the oppressed or the weak or the orphans. So totally the concept and the idea of glory, and even in the present day, this is such, these wrong notions and these wrong things were considered to be glorious and to have grandeur within them. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, in this beautiful conversation, he replies and he says that these things are not considered to be glorious, and nor do they bring about glory, nor do they bring about grandeur. And quite the opposite, and quite surprising, and almost to the point where one is left speechless, Imam al-Jawad replies and says that all glory is for one who fears the Almighty Allah, Allahu Akbar. It is such a different take on the idea of glory and grandeur, right? Even to the present day, thousands of years after the martyrdom of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, people have the wrong notion and the wrong idea of glory and grandeur. They believe that glory and grandeur are all those things that we previously listed. But here in this conversation, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he comes and very beautifully he says that one who fears the Almighty Allah is truly glorious and has grandeur and has majesty. This in itself is such a beautiful and profound statement, because you consider fear to be something which is humiliating, degrading, something that, you know, you are subjected to that. And it is true, if you fear another human being, it is humiliation and it is dhilla. It is degradation and this kind of humiliation of the self. But here, when one fears the Almighty Allah, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says to us that this is true glory and this is true grandeur. And so all glory is for one who fears the Almighty, the Rabb, the Merciful, the Compassionate, the All-Powerful, the Almighty, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam al-Jawad salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi is an interesting case study for many, many different subjects. Well, according to the sources, the uncle of Imam Rida reports to us, لَقَدْ نَصَرَ اللَّهُ أَبُ الْحَسَنَ رِضَى لَمَّا بَغَى عَلَيْهِ إِخْوَتَ وَعُمُومَتَ. This is very profound. The uncle of Imam Rida tells us, and according to the riwayah from Al-Kafi, that the uncles and close relatives of Imam Rida rebelled against him because he appointed this boy as the imam. We're not talking, my dear brothers and sisters, about outsiders. We're talking about the uncles and relatives of the eighth imam from within so-called, shall we say, the jama'at, the inner core circle group of which they had. This is a musibah. I don't know how many of us even know about this, of what transpired exactly. These are very sensitive things that the imam speaks about. فَقَالَ لَهُ إِخْوَتَ. So his brother said, you know, Imam Rida, we have to have a sit down with you. There's a problem. You've appointed this person, this young boy, as the imam, this toddler really at that time. وَنَحْنُ أَيْضًا, he says, and I was among those as well who said something. مَا كَانَ فِينَا إِمَامٌ قَطْعٌ هَائِلُ اللَّوْنِ. He says that we've never had such a dark imam. Can you imagine? We're not talking about Abbasid zalims and oppressors and sultans. We're talking about people who don't like the fact that the ma'asum imam and the hujjat of Allah could be of a dark complexion. Think of the bigotry. Think of the racism, the asabiyah here going on. His uncles. Think of the madlumiyat of Imam Rida and Imam al-Jawad. So they said that we've never had an imam who was unattractive to them, is what they're trying to say. Because of course their conception of beauty was only superficial, of course. At least in their mind of what they could see. Not to say the imam was not beautiful, but in their eyes that's what they judged to be beautiful or to be not beautiful. In their very ignorant and distorted way of looking at the world. Then they went further. Now, maybe not the uncles, but outsiders now. So some of the people who claimed to love the imam, but weren't true Shia. Then they went a step further, that because this child is of such a different complexion, that he may not even be the son of the imam altogether. Can you imagine they would insult the imam and his son in this way?
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The ex-Pakistani Prime Minister was detained on Tuesday afternoon while leaving the Islamabad High Court premises in a stunning turn of events. Khan was arrested by a team of the country's anti-corruption body that was arrested by a large contingent of paramilitary troops when he was making his attendance in two cases related to sedition and attempted murder. Khan's graft case is one of over 100 cases registered against him since he was ousted from power in a parliamentary vote in April last year. The former PM has been accusing the government as well as the top military officials of involvement in assassination plot against him, which was denied by both. Just hours before his arrest, Khan said in his last video message that he will prefer to die rather than accept slavery.
I might have been arrested in a false case when this message reaches all of you. The fundamental rights and democracy have been vanished from the country. Whatever happening at the moment is because of this imported government. So it's time for all of you to take to the streets for real freedom of the country.
The government says that Khan's arrest was made in accordance with the law as he was involved in corruption of 119 million British pounds.
Jis waqt ye corruption kar raha tha.
Mr. Khan was doing corruption along with his family and friends when he was the Prime Minister. The embezzled money was deposited in a trust which was registered under Imran Khan and his wife's name. The money should have been deposited in the National Treasury but went into a property which was registered under a trust.
Following the arrest, thousands of Khan's supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to protest their leader's detention. Clashes between police and protesters were also reported in all major cities and towns of the country.
The arrest of the former Pakistani Prime Minister has further fueled the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
On May 9th, Russia commemorates the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union and the 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians killed in the World War II, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War. This year, the victory parade on Red Square in the heart of Russian capital Moscow was held without the usual aerial maneuvers and with a minimum of equipment. With the latest military developments in the Ukraine war, fighter jets, tanks and missile defense systems were partly showed, as they are needed today at the front line. In his Victory Day speech, President Vladimir Putin said that the real war is once again unleashed against Russia, but the country will ensure its security and protect the inhabitants of Donbas.
Boundless ambition, arrogance and impunity inevitably lead to tragedies. This is the reason for the catastrophe the Ukrainian people are going through. They have become hostage to the coup d'etat and the resulting criminal regime of its Western masters, collateral damage in the implementation of the cruel and self-serving plans.
Vladimir Putin also criticized the demolition of monuments to Soviet soldiers and said the West is creating a Nazi cult. The president pointed out that the desecration of a generation of victors is a crime.
It is a crime, an outright revanchism on the part of those who were cynically and blatantly preparing a new march on Russia and who brought together neo-Nazis come from around the world for this. Their goal, and there is nothing new about it, is to break apart and destroy our country, to make null and void the outcomes of World War II, to completely break down the system of global security and international law, to chalk off any sovereign centers of development.
At 14, I became a partisan, then an infantryman, machine gunner. This is our victory, and we have won this memory. We see the depressing example of Europe. I want to say that Russians will never forget this day and will always remember it. Here, it will always be honored.
I'm from Makeyevka, from Donbas. My entire mining family has perished since 2014. Only one son remained. And today, I've come here in Moscow to pay my debt to all the defenders, the soldiers of our past and present.
Unlike last year, the Russian president did not announce new measures to support the participants in the special military operation, but noted the leaders of the CIS countries who came to celebrate Victory Day in Moscow. Together with Putin, the leaders of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan watched the parade on Red Square.
For millions of Russians, May the 9th is a lot more than a national celebration. Today, Russians celebrate their victory over the Nazis in 1945. The Russians are one of the last who celebrate this holiday officially, remember which side were the heroes, and at what cost the Soviets got this victory. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
Israeli warplanes carried out a series of airstrikes at Pride on Tuesday, which resulted in the death of three high-profile military commanders of the Islamic Jihad movement, Tariq Izzeddin, Khalil al-Bahdini, and Jihad al-Ghanim. The Ministry of Health confirmed the death of 13 Palestinians altogether, including women and children, among them the wives and children of the Islamic Jihad commanders. 20 others were also injured, some of them in serious condition. The Israeli airstrikes, which targeted the middle of the Gaza City and Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern of the coastal enclave, caused a great destruction of the residential apartment buildings as well.
I was asleep, and suddenly the explosion broke out and the rubble fell on us. My granddaughter was asleep by my side. We both woke up, not able to see anything from the destruction.
The Israeli occupation has a record in killing Palestinian civilians, children and women. Today, Maya Azadeen and Haja al-Bahdani, two Palestinian girls, the daughters of the Islamic Jihad leaders, fell victim to the Israeli attacks, like the other thousands of innocent children that were killed before.
Palestinian resistance movements have mourned the martyrs and the family members and condemned the Israeli assassination. In several statements released, they have warned the Israeli occupying regime of the scale and the scope of the Palestinian response to the crime.
The Israeli assassination of the Al-Quds Brigade's commanders is going to cost the Israeli occupation a heavy price. It is a legitimate right to fight the Israeli occupation, and it's the resistance's duty to defend the Palestinian people against any Israeli aggression.
The heinous atrocity of the Israeli occupation that resulted in the assassination of three senior leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement and other civilians will see the Palestinian resistance factions unite in their crushing response as usual. We have the right to resist the Israeli occupation as it continues to commit war crimes against our people.
Thousands of Palestinians carried the bodies of the martyrs from the hospital to the Grand Al-Umari Mosque and then to the final destination to bury them in the northern Gaza Strip. Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets to express their anger over the Israeli crime that resulted in the death of innocent women and children. Palestinians are now calling for retaliation. The Palestinian resistance factions are now preparing for a crushing response to the Israeli attack and the assassination of the Islamic Jihad commanders, affirming their unity against the regime. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
The fifth international exhibition of the export capabilities of Iran is underway at Tehran International Permanent Fairground from May 7th to 10th. The event aims to help companies export their products, develop new markets, and promote their industries while focusing on the importance of non-oil exports. One of the most successful contributors to Iran's non-oil revenues is the country's free industrial and trade zones, which accounted for one-third of the country's non-oil exports last year. During a press conference, the secretary of Iran's Free Zones High Council, said 370 major investment projects are going to be executed in 7 free trade zones across the country, and all investors are welcome to participate in these projects.
Our colleagues have conducted preliminary studies about investment in the 7 free industrial and trade zones. Preliminary justification plans have been prepared, which shows that these projects are going to be profitable. Studies related to the market, land, energy, etc. have also been conducted.
There are 7 active free zones in Iran, including Kish, Chabahar, Qeshm, Anzali, Aras, Arvand, and Maku. According to official statistics, the free zones' productions were about $1 billion last year. One of the most important free zones with lots of potential is the Chabahar free zone.
Chabahar Free Zone is located near the Mokran coastal region. Based on the description of the Islamic Republic of Iran's leader, this region is a hidden treasure in Iran. He has mentioned this several times. As the third energy hub of the country, petrochemical units are going to be opened in Chabahar. These units will begin production after 2 years, and their products will be ready to be introduced to the global market.
Free zones have helped the process of development of Iran through providing conditions that have attracted foreign investors.
Customs and transportation services are much better in the free zones. Also, there are better investment opportunities there. Aras Free Zone is one of the 7 free zones in Iran. This zone has been very successful in industrial activities as well as agriculture.
Officials say the development of projects in free zones is expected to attract a huge volume of investment valued at $5 billion to Iran's economy. The projects are also going to generate new employment opportunities for 23,000 job-seeking people at large. Iran Expo 2023 has introduced hundreds of investment opportunities in the country's trade and industrial free zones. The free zones of Iran, as one of the important tools of development, play an important role in the prosperity of the national economy. Ahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Srinagar, which is the main city of Indian-administered Kashmir, has been given a significant facelift, something that has not happened in decades. Roads are freshly finished, sidewalks fixed, cycle tracks laid, and new colorful signboards placed. All arrangements came after New Delhi-backed administration announced that it will host G20 meeting sessions in Kashmir. Now authorities say G20 meetings have come as a blessing to Srinagar's developmental projects.
We are at a very advanced stage of most of work in many of our projects. Similarly, what we are also doing is that we have started working in the double shift. So in the night also, the work keeps on going. So with the same intention that this progress of the work should speed up. Now, G20 came as a boon to us. It's a good opportunity for us to further speed up. And I think it has helped us in overall, pushing our work on top gear and helping us better coordinate and making sure that we complete many of these projects at a much faster pace.
The projects which were in a wait list for the past 5 years have been completed in a matter of no time. The citizens have appreciated the pace of the work but are criticizing some aspects.
For the people living in Srinagar, these projects make no sense. We wanted road widening for the ease of transport in the city center. Instead, they've shrunk the roads and broadened sidewalks. The administration is yet to make its decisions clear to the citizens. They've just made parts of Srinagar as a showpiece.
Smart city.
They have dug up the entire city and we are really fed up. There is no plan for the city. The businesses have been strongly dented. We are a tourism-based economy, but tourists are not even coming this way. So what sort of smart city planning is this? This is public money and people have not been taken on board.
India is expected to host 215 meetings at some 55 locations this year. Following India's move, Pakistan has accused India of exploiting its membership in G20 to advance its, quote, self-serving, unquote, agendas. However, India has called these decisions as internal matter. The meetings will be the first major international event held in Kashmir since Narendra Modi-led BJP government scrapped Kashmir's semi-autonomous special status in August 2019. The legislations divided the Muslim-majority region into two federally administered territories.
The stage is all set and Srinagar is all ready to host the G20 meetings. Experts say G20 meetings in Kashmir is an opportunity for India to display the return of normalcy in the conflict-ravaged Kashmir. However, people of the region say New Delhi's good work in Kashmir must not revolve around the G20 meetings alone. It must move beyond and look for the larger good of people who have suffered for decades. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida became the first Japanese leader to visit South Korea for a bilateral summit after 12 years. Despite ongoing historical disputes, President Yoon has reached out to Tokyo with plans to possibly include Japan in its alliance with the U.S.
Both countries are exposed to North Korea's nuclear threats, and the military cooperation is needed more than ever. The Washington Declaration at the moment is an agreement between South Korea and the U.S., but we do not rule out the possibility of Japan's participation.
Japanese Prime Minister Kishida sought to reassure South Koreans over the impending release of contaminated water from the 2011 nuclear disaster. He also welcomed the opportunity for Japan to participate in a network of military alliances.
North Korea continues to carry out provocations in the region, and there is a sign that there is an attempt to change the current status by force. Based on this assessment, we agreed we have to strengthen deterrence and ability to respond to threats through Japanese-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-Japanese alliance, and the trilateral alliance.
Both supporters and detractors rallied outside the presidential compound. Many opposed President Yoon's outreach to Japan and militaristic pro-U.S. policies and question his patriotism.
Is President Yoon Suk-yeol, who is driving the Korean Peninsula towards Cold War confrontation while taking the lead in representing the interest of the United States and Japan, is he really the president of South Korea?
South Koreans have also been critical of President Yoon for creating a South Korean foundation to compensate victims of Japan's colonial rule. Improved relations between South Korea and Japan will no doubt be welcomed by the U.S., which wants to see a strengthened trilateral military alliance. And despite domestic opposition, President Yoon seems fully committed, with the largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated to start later this month. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know, Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why were many mainstream platforms? So what the royal family stands for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
African Americans make up about 14% of America's population of 332 million. Almost a third of prisons across the United States are filled with African Americans. According to human rights activists, black people are the biggest systematic victims of police brutality in the United States. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. At the end of a historic two-week tour of the United States, a United Nations mission has concluded that the country must move beyond piecemeal reform and slogan-making and tackle the ongoing scourge of police brutality and law enforcement's discrimination against African Americans. United Nations experts completed their first official visit to the United States as part of a system of global inquiries set up by Human Rights Council after the police murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. As they ended their tour of the United States on Friday, 5th of May, in Washington, D.C., the United Nations experts called for a nationwide commitment to address discrimination suffered by black Americans in their daily dealings with law enforcement. Dr. Tracy Kissi, one of two independent UN experts who conducted the visit, said, "In the United States, racial inequity dates back to the very creation of this country, and there are no quick fixes." Dr. Tracy Kissi added, "To this day, racial discrimination permeates through encounters with law enforcement, from first contact, arrest, detention, sentencing, and disenfranchisement." Dr. Kissi said, "What was needed was a whole government approach," adding, "This needs to be more than a slogan and calls for reform." In the course of their 15-day mission, Dr. Tracy Kissi and Juan Menendez of Argentina visited six U.S. cities: Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Georgia, Los Angeles, California, Chicago, Illinois, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and New York. Their mission was to investigate excessive use of force, militarized policing, racial profiling, and other human rights violations by law enforcement and penal agencies against black Americans. As they crisscrossed the country, the United Nations experts had emotional encounters with families of the victims of police killings and brutality and other law enforcement abuses. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, where a white police officer murdered George Floyd on 25th of May 2020, the panel spent time with the mothers of Philando Castile and Amir Locke, who were also killed by law enforcement in Minneapolis. Presenting their preliminary findings, Dr. Tracy Castile said they had witnessed a pattern that could be traced to what she called the deep intrinsic legacy of slavery and legalized discrimination. She said that across the country, there remained a lack of awareness and acknowledgement of the extent to which racial inequities were still prevalent in the United States. The United Nations experts said the result was a culminating exhaustion in the black community. Juan Mendez of Argentina, a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on torture, said he had been moved throughout the visit by the harrowing pain of victims and their families and the resounding calls for accountability. Juan Mendez said, "We support those calls for accountability." He was heartened by successful prosecutions of police officers involved in high-profile killings, such as those of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky. However, many more cases remained unresolved, suggesting a continuing degree of impunity. Juan Mendez added that their mission would be calling on U.S. Justice Department to make more serious and proactive use of its power through consent decrees to intervene in the inner workings of local police departments to address some of the most egregious abuses. Mendez said, "More robust government action is needed." The United Nations experts will present their final report to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland in September or October of this year. They indicated that among the demands they are likely to make is a call for better nationwide data and record keeping. Juan Mendez said, in the absence of a national database, police officers who had complaints of misconduct or excessive use of force filed against them were allowed to continue serving, in some cases going on to be involved in killings of African Americans. He added, the mechanism also received allegations of police officers who were previously guilty and or disciplined for misconduct, afterwards being hired by a different police department. Among other likely demands signaled by the United Nations experts were, 1. A call for an end to racial profiling in policing in America. 2. A dramatic reduction in the use of solitary confinement in U.S. jails and prisons. And a total abolition of isolated incarceration for children under the age of 18. 3. Passage of George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which tackles racial bias and excessive use of force by law enforcement, but which has stalled in Congress. 4. An end to stereotyping of black women and girls as angry and aged up. 5. Rooting out of white supremacist law enforcement officers to ensure that they no longer wear a police badge. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Activists have urged California State to provide millions of dollars in compensation to black American citizens as a means of apologizing for slavery and past injustices, rejecting the State Reparations Task Force proposal as inadequate. The 9-member Reparations Task Force, established through the state laws endorsed by Governor Gavin Newsom of the Democratic Party in 2020, has spent over 12 months on research while hosting sessions to listen to the public across California. Their efforts have culminated in a comprehensive plan on how to address various instances of racist injustices through restitution. The panel was receiving final feedback from citizens on Saturday, 6th of May, while examining ultimate proposals to present to the California Assembly, which will subsequently determine whether to execute the actions and forward them to Gavin Newsom's office for endorsement. The latest proposal came out recently suggesting a total amount of $1.2 million per person based on the average life expectancy. The estimates include a loss of $2,352 for every individual annually who resides in California due to excessive policing in black communities, a loss of $3,366 per individual annually for bias lending and zoning, a loss of $13,619 per individual annually for unfairness and prejudice in healthcare, and a loss of $77,000 per individual due to the devaluation and loss of black-owned businesses. Meanwhile, activists present at the gathering dismissed the current plan as insufficient. San Francisco is considering its own compensation plans at the community level, which consists of a suggestion to distribute $5 million to eligible black inhabitants. The report did not specify the expenses incurred by the state, but according to economists' approximations in March, the overall expenses due to the negative effects of housing and mass imprisonment could exceed $800 billion. In addition to monetary considerations, the task force suggests a number of policy modifications to address racial bias, including an official apology from the California legislature and from the governor of California for past instances of slavery and anti-black racism. A nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California report revealed that in California, black families earn 60 cents for every dollar earned by white families. Nearly 6.5% of California residents, roughly 2.5 million people, identify as black or African American. Other cities across the United States have also moved forward with reparations proposals. Authorities in Evanston, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, authorized $10 million in reparations as housing allowances in 2021. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors has also expressed support for reparations that could offer several million dollars.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the life and works of the Muslim, Shiite personalities and ulama all across the world. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have two very special guest speakers for today's discussion, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Fazlullah Kajuri, but mainly known as Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, one of the most outstanding mujtahideen of Tehran, one of the forerunners of Mashruta, of course, Mashruta in the sense of Mashru'a movement in Iran. He politically was very much active, and finally he was executed, unfortunately. Let's get to his early life, Sheikh Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sheikh Fazlullah Kajuri or Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, give us some details about his early life and scholarly life, and then we'll get to his political and social life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, the great martyr, Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri.
Yes.
He was born in Mazandaran, one of the cities of Mazandaran, which is known as Nur. So that's why he was known as Nuri. And his father was from a scholarly family. He belonged to a scholarly family. That's why he became a scholar. On top of that, he was from the students of Mirza Shirazi, the great Mirza, who issued the Fatwa of Tobacco. And we can see, like, at the time when he was studying next to the Mirza Shirazi, Sheikh Naini was there, Ayatollah Hayri was there. You know, these famous personality, Koh Kamrei, these were the students of, Mirza Shirazi, who were the, we can say, like classmates or the one who studied at that time next to Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri. So basically, he was a great scholar. And in his initial life after the birth, when he studied, he went to the to Samarra. And he studied there as well. He was in Najaf as well. And therefore, he had some famous students as well, like Muhammad Baqir Qaini, Birjandi. There was Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani.
Yes.
These were the personalities. And on the other hand, he was one of the active members at the time when Mirza Shirazi gave the fatwa against the tobacco.
Yes.
He was very much, active in Iran at that time, Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri. And he was from those activists who were against the any kind of invader, who were against the any kind of person who's ruling the Muslim land but not a Muslim. So he was one of the great scholars.
That's all right. Okay, what were her main political movements, Sheikh Rouhani, on that time? We know that, can I say, the Mashruta movement on that time were active. Some scholars like Ahund Khorasani and Sheikh Fazlullah were first, we can say, supporting it, Mirza Naini too. But when it was deviated from the right path of Islam, then it was criticized by these ulama too. But as long as Mashruta against the kingdom movement and the foreign powers was in line with Islam and Islamic values, it was approved by sheikhs like Fazlullah Nuri, isn't it so?
Yes, the movement of constitutionalism,
yes,
which was firstly supported by the great scholars like Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, but later they came actually to this conclusion that this movement is deviated by some of the people, so that's why they did not support that. But what matters most here in the life of Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri is this, that he was politically a very active scholar in the fields of political kind of affairs and social affairs. That's why I think because of this movement that was in that day very much, let's say, well known and was welcomed by the majority of the people. So that's why it was the responsibility of the scholars like Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri and the others to support it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when it comes to the fatwa of tobacco by Mirza Shirazi,
yes,
when Nasiruddin Shah actually ordered Mirza Hassan Ashtiani to smoke hookah or pipe publicly,
yes,
among the people,
yes, yes,
in order to oppose the fatwa of Mirza Shirazi,
mm-hmm,
and to support this contract between the king and the Britishers, then he told him, actually, the king ordered him either to publicly smoke the hookah or to leave the city and go outside the city. So Mirza Hassan Ashtiani decided to not to smoke. Rather, he preferred to go outside the city. And then he went in a, outside the city in a house.
Yes.
He was alone there. Then it is said that the first scholar who went to that house and visit Mirza Hassan Ashtiani was Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri.
Okay.
Rahmatullahi alayh.
Yes.
So you see that at that time, Mirza Hassan Ashtiani was alone because he opposed the orders and the commandment of the king. It was really a challenging situation for Hassan Ashtiani.
That's right.
And in that kind of situation, if you support a scholar, though it would be very much dangerous for you yourself, you know?
Okay.
But despite the fact that it was dangerous for Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, but he decided to support Mirza Hassan Ashtiani.
That's right.
And then they together supported Mirza-i Shirazi. It shows that the scholars were united at that time.
That's right.
Supporting each other. That's why this movement against tobacco was successful, because of the supports that Mirza-i Shirazi received from these great scholars like Mirza Hassan Ashtiani and Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
He was living in Tehran, so he was under, you can say, the control of the power of the kings. And he was executed, you know, he was assassinated and executed in public. So even the picture of his execution is over there, you know. For example, you can Google it. It is over there that, for example, this outstanding sheikh of Tehran executed. What was the main reason, Said Musa?
Well, obviously, in this movement, we can say like the constitutional movement or the Mashrute, basically.
Yes.
The main idea behind that was we don't want to live under the invasion of England or Russia or any power, which is a non-Muslim. Rather, if even we have a Muslim, we can say king or leader, which is not bound to Islam, but he will concern the ulama for the rulings and all those, and he will rule this Islamic land. Being a Muslim, then it is fine for the ulama of that time. This was Mashruta, basically. And Sheikh Naini was after it. Akhund Khurasani was there. After Akhund Khurasani, Sheikh Naini has led the thing, and he wrote a book, Tanzihul Ummah.
Yes. Tanzihul Ummah wa Tanbihul Millah.
Yes,
yes.
So this was the book which is the constitutional book in which he wrote about different aspects. How can we can have a Muslim leader who is not a practicing Muslim as that?
Because these sheikhs were supported.
Yes.
And after it was deviated.
The main idea was we don't want non-Muslims to be the leader.
Non-Muslims to be
the
leader.
That was the main idea behind it. Now, Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri opposed this idea. He said, I do not accept a non-practicing Muslim to be the leader.
Mm-hmm.
If there must be a leader, that leader should be the representative of the Imam of the time.
Uh-huh.
He should be a faqih from the Sharia. He should bring the Sharia and he should impose the Sharia into the Muslim land, which is very much close to the idea which we have in today's world as Vilayat al-Faqih in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So basically this Vilayat al-Faqih, that the Vilayat al-Faqih is on the top, the Wali al-Faqih is at the top, and then he is controlling everything. And under his, we can say, control, everything is running and the country has been run. So this was the main idea of Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri. Now what happened is, because he had this and he said that whoever goes after Mashruta, it is haram. On the other hand, we had three people, like, for example, Sayyid Abdullah Behbahani, Sayyid Muhammad Tabatabai, and these were the ulama of Najaf. They basically issued a fatwa against Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri.
Yes.
And they said, because Nuri is, you know, is making a resistance against our movement, and he is making the, we can say, like, chaos amongst the people, that's why it is haram for him. It is forbidden for him to involve in the matter of the people. And this became the ground for the Pahlavis, because when they came to when they got the ruling, what the Pahlavis has done is basically they got the ruling and they never concerned the ulama, rather they banned the ulama. And on top of that, on the basis of these fatwas which was given at the time of that movement, they have said that the Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri is one of the ones who is spreading the corruption amongst the people, if Sadil fil Arz, basically.
Okay.
And under that category, they hanged him in the in front of people. But the main thing is, the main idea of the Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, which is accepted by the Imam Khomeini and the Supreme Leader of Iran at this time, because they talk a lot about him, is that his idea was right. Because, when we are a Shia, being a Shia, we know that the infallible Imam has the right to rule over the people.
That's all right.
And in his absence, obviously, it's the representative of the Imam.
Unfortunately, a fake fatwa was published on that time that, for example, the ulama in Najaf has said that Sheikh Fazlullah must be executed. But the exact date was 2 years before that, and it was a public one, that whoever wants to find control over the public funds of the people of Muslim lands must be executed. It was about the Britishers, the Russians, and the kings, and not Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, okay? So then, unfortunately, this was done in a fake form. And about his execution ceremony, it is that he was in prison for some days. He was in praying. He did not show any weakness, for example, not asking for his life. He said, I acted according to my own jihad. And this was my duty as a Muslim, to act against the non-Muslim or the so-called Muslim king of the time. I do not regret what I said about the king. And Islam, and as you said, a Muslim ruler must act and rule in a country like Islamic Republic of Iran and the whole Muslim lands. He was executed, unfortunately, in Tehran. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Lady Fatimatul Masuma. It is in one of the chambers or rooms around the mirror veranda, we can say, of the holy shrine of Hazrat Masuma. In one room over there, Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri is buried over there. As you said, so many outstanding people, like, for example, Sayyid Murtaza Avini, Jalal Al Ahmad, we can say the late Imam Khomeini, has concerned Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri as one of the shining stars of the revolution against tyranny of the modern era. And this has been very much outstanding about his life. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
A teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.